argument today is RCBA Nutraceuticals against Pro Ampac Holdings. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Terry Johnson and I appear on behalf of the plaintiff, RCBA Nutraceuticals LLC. This case involves a series of what now are obvious errors by the district court in determining and applying what it believed to be the applicable statute of limitations. The case law in question, both the Haley case from the Western District and the Abrams case from the state courts, indicate that in applying the borrowing statute, what determines whether there is a foreign statute of limitations, a foreign claim subject to a statute of limitations, is whether the final significant event giving rise to a suable claim, in this case a suable claim in contract, since the district court had disposed of all the other claims in the complaint on other grounds, and the district court applied that decision, that rule, incorrectly. And as a starting point, we know it applied it incorrectly because the result it reached is absurd. What the result it reached is that Texas or New York law controlled the statute of limitations, even though the only involvement New York or Texas had under the pleadings that are controlling in this case on a motion to dismiss is that third-party independent contracting agents for the plaintiff who agreed to fill the material in the bags supplied by the defendant were located in New York and in Texas, and that at some point in time they received reports that the bags were failing. That's the only involvement of Texas or New York in this case. And yet, by the reasoning that the district court applied, it concluded that the statute of limitations
Wisconsin law provides. That's what Wisconsin law provides.
But it doesn't.
You don't get any mileage just by saying, well, the losing side says this is absurd. You have to analyze the decisions of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin.
And I was going to get to that, but I start from the premise that the result is so obviously incorrect.
That does you no good at all.
I disagree, but I understand your point. So let me go into the analysis. First of all, the district court concluded that New York and Texas controlled because the final significant event giving rise to a suable claim in contract occurred when notice was given to the third parties in Texas and in New York. The problem with that is that event was not a significant event relating to a suable claim in contract, much less the final one.
Do we know, Mr. Johnson, the sequence as between New York Texas finding out items and then consumers complaining?
No, we don't, and I'm going to get to that in just a moment. But the first point is getting notice of a problem with the performance of someone is not an element of a claim in contract, and so it can't be a final significant event in creating a suable claim. The elements of a breach of contract claim are contract, breach, causation, and damages. The final event that gave rise to a suable claim in contract in this case is clearly when the plaintiff sustained damages. And by the district court's own finding at page 17 of its decision in talking about jurisdiction, it observed that the defendant had conceded that the only damages in this case were economic damages and that those damages were incurred by the plaintiff in Florida where it's incorporated and does business. So the whole idea that this notice, whenever it occurred, in whatever order it occurred, whatever it was the final significant event giving rise to a suable claim and contract is erroneous. It isn't. The final event giving rise to a suable claim and contract is the sustaining of damages, which by everyone's agreement occurred in Florida, which if that meant that was the determining fact on which statute of limitations applied, would dictate that Florida law applied. The court concluded Florida law didn't apply. That's clearly an incorrect application and analysis of the statute and of the case law that controls under the statute.
I thought that the analysis here was a little bit different than that. You tell me I'm mistaken. I thought because you're dealing with the sale of goods, these little baggies or packages, the first time that there was any indication that there may have been a defect in them is when they were delivered to the filling companies or whatever we were calling them. And therefore, go ahead.
That's what the court concluded, and I'll talk about that now because that's wrong.
Right. So when you go through the elements of contract, I think your description of a contract claim is correct, but isn't that the moment at which the breach is first discernible?
But that's not the test. The test is, under the case law, under the Haley case and the Abrams case, what's the final significant event giving rise to a suable claim? Not when did you discover it. That's the discovery rule. It's what's the final significant event giving rise to a suable claim in contract? That happened when we were damaged. We were damaged in Florida by everyone's agreement because we began to sustain financial damages, and that's where it was occurred. But I'll get to the second point. The court was clearly incorrect when it said the final significant event occurred when the notice was given to these third-party fillers, as they're called, in Texas and New York, because the complaint doesn't allege that that's what happened first. It says notice happened, and it happened three ways. At some point in time, the company started to get direct complaints from customers about bags failing. At some point in time, it got complaints from 12 different distributors all around the world that bags were failing. And at some point in time, these fillers got notice. But there's nothing in the pleading that says the order in which those events occur. So if as the court said, when is the chain, so to speak, completed? When is the final significant event is the first time someone got notice? We don't know under the complaint which was the first time someone got notice.
And is this the same problem, Mr. Johnson, that for count four, the civil conspiracy, and count five, fraudulent misrepresentation, where the court just can't come up with a date?
I think it's in a different sense. Under those issues, it is because of the discovery rule, because they're tort claims. In this case, it's because of the language used in the statute. But there's a third problem with what the court said, and I think that gets to what Judge Estabrook had asked about. The court then concluded that because, in its view, erroneously, the last event, significant event giving rise to the claim happened in either New York or Texas, that meant New York and Texas statute of limitations had to control. But that's not what the statute says. The statute simply says, as interpreted by the court, that test determines whether you have a foreign claim for purposes of the borrowing statute. And so even if the court was right in concluding that getting notice is the final significant event, it's wrong. And the court was right that the complaint said the final significant event first happened in New York or Texas, he's wrong. That doesn't dispose of the question of what statute of limitations applies, because neither Haley nor Abrams talk about that, because there apparently was no issue in those cases. There were only two states involved. In Haley, one state is Wisconsin, where the defective windows were made, and the other state is, for each of the separate plaintiffs, what state they had their windows fail in where they lived. There was no third or fourth state to talk about in terms of what statute is. But the statute doesn't say that once you determine it's a foreign claim pursuant to the borrowing statute, that the state in which the last significant event occurs determines what the foreign statute of limitations is. That's a leap in logic that's not supported by the case law or by the statute. Instead, as we argued in our brief, what you should do is look at traditional choice of law sorts of considerations then to say, okay, now we've decided it's a foreign claim. That brings the borrowing statute into play. What would be the foreign statute of limitations that would apply to compare it to the Wisconsin statute of limitations so you can determine which one's shorter, which is then controlling? The court didn't do any of that. It just said, because the final event occurred in either New York or Texas, that means their statute applies. And that's why I pointed out the absurd result. Because it's obvious that if we were going to apply any kinds of traditional choice of law rules, the only two states that could possibly apply would be Florida, where my client's located, where it entered into these negotiations, where it sustained the damages, or Wisconsin, where the product was made. The borrowing statute says you can't use Wisconsin because the Florida statute of limitations is shorter, but it doesn't say you have to use the state in which the final significant event occurred. That only determines whether or not you have a foreign claim so that the borrowing statute even comes into play. If that last significant event occurred in Wisconsin, using the judge's logic, if the distributor had been in Wisconsin and had gotten the bags, and it really was the first notice, and that really was the final significant event, none of which is true. But if it was, then we'd look at Wisconsin law and say it's not a foreign claim because the last significant event occurred in Wisconsin. So we don't look at the borrowing statute. Because it occurred, we would say, in Florida, they apparently say now Texas or New York, the borrowing statute applies. But that doesn't tell us, and there's nothing in the case law that tells us, that we then pick a state which is a complete stranger to the action in every other respect and apply its statute of limitations. That would mean that if the president of the plaintiff had been traveling in Brazil and run into someone who had bought a bag of these goods with this bag, and they found out they were on a plane or a bus or someplace in Brazil, and he said, you know what, that's funny. I just bought a bag of your nutritional supplement, and it failed. So I went and bought another one, and it failed, and I thought I should let you know it. I was going to write you a letter, but I'm telling you now. Now Brazil law applies? I mean, that makes no sense. And there's nothing in the statute, and there's nothing in the case law that suggests it is the result. That's why this district court was clearly wrong, and you should reverse. Thank you.
Mr. Bertocchi.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joel Bertocchi, and I represent Pro-Ampac Holdings, Inc., the appellee and defendant in the case. I was going to talk about waiver, but Mr. Johnson didn't talk about any of the waived arguments, so I will go right to what he was talking about. Much of what Mr. Johnson was arguing is exactly what the Wisconsin borrowing statute was designed to avoid. Who's got the most significant contacts? Where it's absurd that this case be decided on Texas and New York law, because they have nothing to do with it. Well, those are the places. I mean, not that it's necessary, because as Abrams makes clear, as Scott makes clear, that is exactly why the borrowing statute and the final significant test is applied. And it's worth mentioning that this is not a test to apply the rule of decision.
Does Wisconsin have a savings statute like the one in Illinois?
I don't believe, there's none cited, Your Honor.
There's certainly none being relied on.
No.
I just wondered if they have one.
I don't know, Your Honor, because I have no reason to look, so I didn't. But that this is not the rule of decision. The entire idea behind the borrowing statute for statutes of limitations is to make a simple decision and save the where is it really related to most for when you're deciding whose law applies to liability. In this case, now I will also say that Mr. Johnson had kind of gone off on a red herring chase, if that's not mixing two metaphors, with talking about where the result was communicated. Nothing in what Judge Duffin decided had anything to do with where the result was communicated, where the president of RCBA happened to be when he picked up his phone and somebody said something. In fact, if you look on page star 2 of Judge Duffin's initial ruling, he points out that the complaint says employees at RCBA's filling facilities in New York and Texas discovered the defects. That is, and it cites the complaint at paragraph 70 to 71. That is where the final significant event test was. Now, you could have all kinds of tests, but that's a good test. It's easy to apply. What Mr. Johnson is essentially depending on is the logic of the concurring opinion in the Abrams case, where three of the justices, not a majority, said, you know, this may not be as easy as all that. To which the majority responded in footnote 7 and said, it's a test. Sometimes tests will be hard to apply, sometimes they won't be. But it's a test. And even the concurring opinion agreed that's the right test. Judge Duffin applied the test correctly. It's got nothing to do with when notice was given. He didn't talk about when notice was given.
I think his argument, though, as I heard it, was a little bit different. My point to Mr. Johnson was it seemed that New York and Florida was the location of the breach because that's mm-hmm. the location of the delivery of the non-conforming good.
Yes.
Okay. And his response was,
and
well,
And the discovery of it also, according to the complaint.
Okay, fair enough. His response, though, was, well, that has nothing to do with where the economic harm was realized.
Your Honor, he is not arguing for the final significant event. He is arguing for a rule that would essentially make the place of economic injury the rule. And that's not what Abrams said. That's not what the final significant event test says. The final significant event that resulted in the breach was when it became apparent, when it was discovered by the employees of the filling company. The fact that if we say, well, where did the economic injury occur? It occurred where the company was. That would be a rule that said wherever the plaintiff is located is the statute of limitations you apply. That is not what the Wisconsin rule is. That is
Mr. Bertocchi, though, yes, the sir. Sequence question still arises because you've got these the notice by the filling companies, but you've also got the consumer complaints and other complaints. Do we know which sequence those happened in?
We don't, Your Honor. I'm looking at that paragraph. But
and isn't that sequence important to the idea of first?
Well, Your Honor, but that's why Judge Duffin didn't depend on communication. Customers could be anywhere. But that would be a hard rule to apply. But when did the defect occur? When, you know, when the defective bags were filled, and whether it spilled out of the plant or it was going to, that was the event that triggered the test. And again, this is not a rule of decision test. This is not saying whose law will apply to decide whether my client is liable if we ever got to that point. This is a test, supposed to be a simple, quick test to decide whose statute of limitations applies and to apply the shortest one available, which is what the Wisconsin legislature wanted to do. In the end, Mr. Johnson, I'm not sure whether he meant to say it or slipped out, but he was talking about choice of law rules. That is exactly what Wisconsin courts, the Wisconsin Supreme Court in particular, and even the district courts in Wisconsin applying Wisconsin law have said is the borrowing statute is designed to avoid. It is designed to avoid the complicated choice of law stuff that we all learned in law school and save that for the actual rule of decision as to who will be liable in the case. And so for that reason, Your Honor, Judge Duffin was correct. He picked the right significant event. He applied the right test in the simple and straightforward way it is supposed to be applied. And it is not absurd, but it may not even matter whether it's absurd because the test was applied correctly in this simple, limited function, and for that reason, he should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Johnson?
Briefly. First, I want to make sure we don't have any misunderstanding as to what Judge Duffy said, because it's obvious. On page 24 of his decision, he said, RCBA alleges that it first discovered the defects when it received the bags in Lancaster, New York, and Allen, Texas, where the defective bags were filled with RCBA's nutritional products, citing, among other things, paragraph 71. And then he goes on to say, because the bags failed in RCBA's...
Just pause real quick. Where are you reading from? Just tell me where...
Page 24 of the court's decision.
Okay. All right.
Referencing page 71 of the complaint.
Yeah.
Paragraph 71.
I think that's correct. Further on the same page, it says, because the bags failed in RCBA's New York and Texas filling centers, the claims are foreign causes of action for purposes of Wisconsin's borrowing statute. The problem with that is in the first sentence, mainly, and that is, he said, RCBA alleges that it first discovered the defects. There is no such allegation, and therefore, there is no simple test under the present posture of this case, which is taking the complaint as true, interpreting in a way that saves the cause of action, not causes it to be barred, and then making a decision. Here he read
Thank
into
you,
the
Mr.
complaint
Johnson.
Something that simply doesn't exist.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. Case number